morning. I'm Spencer Beckwith. Today, we're going to take a half hour here on KUNM to talk about opera. Specifically, about a forgotten opera. One written in Italy in the 1860s and based on Shakespeare's Hamlet. The 1860s were part of a period known as the Golden Age of Opera, a time of operatic glory, when literally scores of new works premiered each season in opera houses throughout Europe. These works were part of a larger operatic tradition, one that began in the late 16th century and continues, of course, up to the present day. It's a tradition that encompasses thousands of operas. Only a small fraction of those works, however, are still seen today. A valid question to ask is, can we assume that the operas we do see are the best? Or are they simply the ones that, for whatever reason, have survived? In 2012, Opera Southwest in Albuquerque resurrected Otello, not Giuseppe Verdi's Otello, which is an operatic staple, but Gioachino Rossini's earlier version of Otello, which was an enormous hit in the first half of the 19th century, but then fell out of the operatic repertoire and has rarely been performed since. The Albuquerque production of Rossini's Otello was a huge success, attracting national attention. And this month, Opera Southwest is again reaching back into the golden age of opera to bring modern audiences a work that has not been heard or seen for almost 150 years. Franco Faccio's Amleto opens on October 26th at the National Hispanic Cultural Center and runs through November 2nd. And with us at KUNM is the person who has spent the last several years researching and reconstructing Amleto, the artistic director of Opera Southwest, conductor and composer Anthony Baresi. Tony, it's great to have you with us.
Great to be back.
Now, first of all, tell us about the opera itself. What will people be seeing and hearing at the National Hispanic Cultural Center?
People will be seeing the closest approximation to Shakespeare's Hamlet that I have ever come across in an opera. And I would say maybe with the exception of Britten's Midsummer Night's Dream, which is an opera that uses only Shakespeare's text, this is possibly the most faithful representation of a Shakespeare play that is done in an opera. A lot of times operas loosely base the plot on Shakespeare, but this is one where the composer and the librettist, the person who wrote the text, went out of their way to really make it very much like Shakespeare.
And it follows the mid-19th century tradition, a dramatic tradition of opera, four acts.
Four acts, yes. They've condensed Shakespeare's five acts to four. And it's, you know, Hamlet is Shakespeare's longest play, so there's a lot of paring down. They've reduced the number of characters pretty dramatically, but also have kept a lot of the interesting small parts. And they've kept all of the most iconic parts of the play, the scene on top of the castle, the meeting with the ghost, the confrontation with the mother and the ghost, Ophelia going crazy, to be or not to be, the fencing duel at the end, the graveyard scene with the gravedigger. I mean, everything that you think of when you think of Hamlet is in this opera.
Now, the composer, Franco Faccio, 1840, 1891.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about him.
Faccio was a member of a group of young composers who, and you have to remember, at the time that he was writing this, Verdi was the dominant force in Italian music making. And there were also other composers that we don't know anymore, like Pacini and Mercadante, who were also very, very well known. And there was a big resistance in Italy at the time for anything sort of seen as avant-garde. So Italy has an amazing tradition of operatic music and almost no tradition of, at this time, almost no tradition of instrumental music. So instrumental music was seen as encroaching on the hegemony of the opera. So anything seen a little bit too much on the side of instrumental was seen as a threat. Now, there was a group of young composers and playwrights and artists called the Scapigliatura, which loosely translates to the disheveled ones. They kind of were bohemian in lifestyle. And they wanted to bring the avant-garde to Italy, or what they thought was the avant-garde. So they were a very big proponent components of the music of Richard Wagner, who was then very much in vogue throughout Europe and very much resisted in Italy. And so they were just the typical young, hot-headed upstarts, and they wanted to write a work that would revolutionize Italian music making. And Hamlet really was their manifesto. That was their gauntlet that they threw down, that they wanted to do. And Faccio, you know, he, for all his revolutionary talk, really is so much embedded in that time period. When you hear the music, it does not sound radical in any way, to our ears at least. I would imagine to an Italian in the 1860s, it did sound pretty crazy. But it is firmly rooted in the traditions of what was going on. It sounds kind of like Middle Verdi with maybe a splash of Wagner in it.
And Faccio was very closely related to Verdi. He conducted several of Verdi's operas.
Yes, in the beginning of their career, both Boito and Faccio, you know, were very much kind of vocally anti-Verdi in some ways, and Verdi took great offense. Verdi was one of the great passive-aggressive people in the history of opera. Boito, the person who wrote the text for Amleto, wrote a poem about, it was called To Italian Art, and it was about prophesizing that maybe somebody has already been born who will wash the brothel-stained walls of Italian art. And it was very much directed at Verdi. And Verdi held this grudge to the very end of his life, just would say, oh, well, far be it for me to not clean the brothel walls, but to even sort of joke with them towards, you know, he never forgot it. And so he was very offended even by this idea, I think, at the time. But then later on, they got older, they became part of the establishment, they cooled down. Boito wrote the text for Verdi's last two operas, and Faccio, after Amleto, became the most important conductor in all of Italy. So his career went from composition very early on, and then Amleto really changed everything for him. And then he did conduct many works by Verdi and others, Puccini and Ponchielli, a lot of major heavy hitters.
And you mentioned Arrigo Boito.
Yes.
He is the part of the creative team behind Amleto who most people today will have heard of.
Yes, he wrote an opera in his own right, Mephistopheles, which is done with some frequency. I mean, it's done a lot in Europe, and it's done with some frequency in the United States. But he's most famous for being a librettist. That is the person who writes the text for the opera. And he wrote the words for Verdi's last two operas. He helped with some of the middle operas when Verdi was revising some of them. He wrote the text for Amleto. He wrote quite a few very famous libretti.
Now, tell us a little bit about the history in the middle of the 19th century of Amleto. It premiered in 1865. There was another production in 1871.
It premiered in 1865 in Genoa, and it was quite a success. Genoa was not the leading operatic house in Italy, but it was certainly an important opera house. It had a pretty good success. The critics, you know, were very confident about it, and the composer felt very good about it, had a number of performances. And then both the composer and the librettist joined Garibaldi's forces and fought, you know, for the unification of Italy. And their travels sent them abroad, and they got to go to Germany, and they got to actually hear Wagner's music as opposed to just reading about it. And they became familiar with Beethoven. They became familiar with all these ideas that they so wanted to put into their music. And so Faccio did a major revision on Hamlet. And then there was a production scheduled for 1871 at La Scala, which was the top theater and still is the top theater in Italy. And at the La Scala production, there was a lot of buzz about it. This was going to be a major, major event, obviously, because this young upstart who had a success in Genoa is bringing his opera here. And about a week before the opening night, the tenor, the lead, Hamlet, got very sick, and then they had to postpone it for 2 weeks. They postponed it for 2 weeks, the tenor got better, and then he got sick again. And there's a kind of committee at La Scala that would judge whether or not a singer could go on, and they said, you can go on. You're fine. And even despite the fact that Faccio said he's not in good voice, it's not going to be good, he went on. And from all the contemporary accounts I can read, he was terrible. He just either didn't sing or sang poorly or just took things down instead of singing in the proper pitches. And it was just a huge fiasco, a disaster. It was so bad that Faccio withdrew the work and not only never had it performed again, but never composed again after that night.
Of course, the history of opera is filled with stories just like that, of operas that were massive failures when they opened, and then were then they came back and were great successes.
Yeah.
This did not happen.
This did not happen. Yeah. If, you know, if Verdi were like Faccio, we would not have Traviata in the repertoire. If Puccini were like that, you know, Madame Butterfly was a, they were booing from beginning to end of the premiere. I mean, there were, people were hooting and booing. It was a disaster, way worse than Hamlet. So you have to think that this had a lot more to do with Faccio's sensitivity to the criticism. And he just did. I mean, the Scala production did have some successes. People applauded things. People did. There were encores. It just was just, it was bad enough that Faccio did not feel good about having it done ever again.
Right. So obviously a fit of pique on the part of Faccio.
Yeah.
That might be an indication of what his personality was like.
Exactly. Yeah.
At that time. Pause for a second to say I'm Spencer Beckwith, and I'm talking with Anthony Baresi, artistic director of Opera Southwest in Albuquerque. The company is presenting Tony's reconstructed version of 19th century composer Franco Faccio's lost opera, Amleto. Now, let's talk a little bit about your work on this, Tony, which is fascinating. You were actually able to locate, with the help of your friends and colleagues in the opera world, several documents from which you then reconstructed the Amleto score. Is that correct?
This is correct.
And what kind of documents were those?
So one of the big reasons that this piece has never been performed is that there was no usable musical material that, like, you could get from a library, that you could get. There was not a printed score of the music. And what happened 99% of the time is, even if an opera were a failure, the publisher would make what we call a piano vocal score. Now, that is a piece of music that has the vocal music in it, the voice lines, and a reduction of the orchestra into the form of a piano. So you could kind of look at it. If you were a capable musician, you could sit down at the piano and you could kind of go through it and see what it sounds like. For whatever reason, that did not happen with this opera. So there was not that. That didn't exist. The only thing that existed, there were three things that existed. There were two printed librettos, that is the text of the opera. There was one printed for the premiere in Genoa in 1865, and there was one printed for the La Scala production in 1871. So those were printed. So that showed the text of the opera. And then there was the composer's autograph manuscript score. That is the thing he took quill and pen to and wrote the music.
Full orchestral score.
Full orchestral score, mm-hmm. All the voices. And there was a couple other sort of secondary documents that helped a little bit in the research, but don't really need to talk about here. But for all intents and purposes, those were the three main things. So not only is this an enormous manuscript, you know, hundreds of pages, the pages are crumbling. They're in an archive in Milan. They're not usable in any way. It's in his handwriting, so it's very, you know, it's very idiomatic of the time period. I had to kind of get to learn how to read his handwriting. So this was a process that I started. I got a microfilm. I wrote away to Ricordi, and I wrote to anybody who could help me, where can I find this? And Ricordi found a microfilm that they had made of it, and they sent that to me, and I made photocopies of all the pages and just basically started at page one.
And Ricordi being
Ricordi being the Italian, the major Italian publishing house who also houses the archives of all the manuscripts of all the Italian composers from the beginning of time.
So you started note by note reconstructing this from these documents.
And some pages were fine. I mean, some pages it was very clear what was going on. Some pages had faded considerably to where a lot of the stuff was almost illegible. I had to get down there with a magnifying glass. So a lot of pages, it was really all of my musical training brought together in this one moment, because if I could figure out the vocal line and if I could figure out the bass line, then I could sort of see, I could fill in with my knowledge of harmony and counterpoint and all these other musical techniques, I could fill in with my mind what was going on. So if I saw a horn that looked like it might be playing a C, but it might be a D, I could extrapolate based on other instruments, what they were playing, what that person was playing. So it was a huge puzzle. It was just an enormous jigsaw puzzle that took, now at this point, I've been working on it for 11 years.
And what percentage would you say, Tony, of the score is the decisions that you made?
As far as notes and rhythms and things that you're going to hear, it's all Faccio. I mean, I figured it out. Like, eventually, you know, when you start at page one and you see someone's handwriting, you go, what is this? But then when you live with the person for 11 years, by the end, you go, oh, well, this obviously says this. So a lot of questions were resolved just by the fact of getting to know his idiosyncrasies in writing. There is very little that I had to do an editorial hand in that would in any way be considered heavy. So I tried to keep the lightest editorial hand possible.
Tony, let's go back in time a little bit.
Sure.
To when you first heard about this, which was, I think, in 2002. Why did you want to pursue this?
For me, Hamlet has always been my favorite Shakespeare play, so I've always loved it, and I've also believed that there was not a credible operatic treatment of it. The only one that gets any play these days is this French version by Ambroise Thomas called Hamlet, and it deviates quite significantly from the Shakespeare. And so that, and even Verdi hated that opera. He said, "Oh, how they've massacred Shakespeare," when he heard about it, and he read the libretto. So that was sort of a contemporaneous opera. To the Faccio. So I've never believed that it was a really good, credible operatic source for this. And then I heard that Boito, who I had heard of just because he had written Mephistopheles, he had written these other librettos for other composers, I heard that he wrote a treatment of Hamlet, and I heard it was his first Shakespeare libretto, and I also heard it was his first libretto ever that he wrote when he was 24. So I thought, okay, what is this? And then I started reading about it, and there was very, very little written about it because nobody's heard it. And then I thought, well, okay, why hasn't anyone heard it? And then what started out as just curiosity became a massive project.
And obviously, when you first encountered the score and the libretto, you were encouraged.
I had a lot of time. My career was not as advanced as it is now. I just had a lot of curiosity, and I was younger. You know, I was 11 years younger. I had a lot of energy. And I don't know. It was just something that I wanted to, you know, I would get to a part where, you know, oh, to be or not to be, what does this sound like? You know, I'm just so curious. And then, that kind of is really interesting. And then it would go a little bit further, and I would discover more of these. And then, you know, you get to the halfway part, well, I got to finish this. And then you finish it, and you go, well, I got to edit it and make it look nice. And then, you know, I keep going back and finding things. I mean, almost every day I find little thing, like a mistake here or an error here. It's true needle and haystack work.
Well, as you said, this was a while ago. This was before you had an opera company and were running in Albuquerque. So you were forging ahead without any assurance that this would ever get a production.
Oh,
was,
yeah.
Was that your ultimate goal, to get a production?
I mean, in the beginning, it was just out of curiosity. But once I had finished it, I thought, gosh, I've put a lot of work in this. And people have said this is like PhD-level work that you know, you could have gotten a PhD with the amount of work you put into this. And so at that point, I just had this material that I had reconstructed, and I made a nice, usable, printed, you know, computer-engraved copy of all the materials. And I sold the rights to Recordi, the publishing house, and they, you know, and I shopped it around to really anybody who cared, or even many people who didn't care. I made copies. I sent it out to opera companies. In 2005, we did a private reading of it for Placido Domingo, who was very interested in it at the time. And then he was even considering doing it at Washington National Opera, but that didn't pan out. But when we decided to do it at Opera Southwest, Domingo did write a letter to our board congratulating them actually on their courage in promoting such a work that he thought was important. So, and there have been people who've been sort of peripherally interested here and there, but a lot of people don't want to take a chance on something that no one has heard in 150 years, because the conventional wisdom is, well, there must be a reason, you know. And there's a reason, and the reason is that it didn't really exist in a usable form before now.
And if people want to listen to excerpts from this, they can go to your website.
They can go to my website, absolutely. We are going to live stream the opening night, so you'll be able to hear it on the radio live. Or they can come and see our production, yeah.
Wow. Now, let's talk about this production.
Sure.
It's actually the same creative team as put together the Otello 2 years ago.
Exact same creative team. We have Kerry Wong designing the sets, who did the Otello sets, also our butterfly sets. David Bartholomew, who is the stage director, directed both of those productions, is also directing this. So yeah, it's more or less the same team that brought you Otello.
Talk a little bit about what the three of you discussed when you decided that this was going to be part of the Opera Southwest season. What kind of production did you want this to be?
You know, in the beginning, we didn't know. We were, you know, it's like, what do we do? Do we send this? You know, we always come across this. We hear people want traditional performances. You know, you hear that all the time. Well, what does that mean? You know, do you want to see people in pumpkin pants and cod pieces like they would have done in Elizabethan? Elizabethan wouldn't have said it in like the 1400s Denmark. It would have been Elizabethan. You know, so the idea that people say they want traditional, but do they want men singing the women parts, you know, the way it would have been in Shakespeare's time. Like, it's just such a loaded term, traditional. So we just kind of threw that out because it is at a certain point meaningless, the idea of traditional, especially with this, because it's a piece that doesn't have a tradition because it was only done twice. So we started looking at different time periods, and there was just a lot of talk about when this piece should be set. One of the things that is not in the opera that is in the play is this major political element about Fortinbras in Denmark, you know, clashing with other places, which is interesting sort of in the history of Elizabethan England as a metaphor for what was going on then, but doesn't in no way relates to what's going on operatically. And the opera is about the drama of Hamlet and his madness and his love or whatever and his vengeance. So having gotten that political aspect out of it, that sort of made it narrowed down like when we thought we could set this. So there was a lot of discussion about what elements of the opera we wanted to highlight and what would be good for that. And like most Shakespearean plays, at least of this kind of ilk, I think of Macbeth a lot. You know, scene one, a room in a castle. Scene two, another room in the castle. Scene three, a hall in the castle. You know, so there's sort of a unity. It all takes place more or less in and around Elsinore Castle. So we knew, having a unit set is always something that is a lot easier to do from a financial standpoint. So that's what we're more or less doing, a unit set with some movements that kind of suggest different places in the castle. So it really has been a very long process. I've never worked this closely with a team for this long. I mean, David and I have had daily phone conversations for over a year now at this point. We always have daily phone conversations, but it's usually like, you know, have you seen this, you know, thing on YouTube or whatever, you know. It's always, but it has been work every day, and it's been great and fun and you know, intense work. So it's been just a lot of back and forth about deciding when and where this is going to be set and how we're going to put all these elements together.
I'm Spencer Beckwith, and I'm talking with Anthony Baresi, Artistic Director of Opera Southwest in Albuquerque. The company is presenting Tony's reconstructed version of 19th century composer Franco Faccio's lost opera, Amleto. One of your colleagues who's helped you with this production and putting together the score is Philip Gossett,
yes,
who is a great Rossini scholar. He was in Santa Fe at the Santa Fe Opera, mm-hmm, a couple of years ago working on the reconstruction of Mahometo Segundo, yep, Rossini's opera, which was a big success there. What kind of help did Philip Gossett give you with Amleto?
He opened a lot of doors. So in the beginning when I was trying to get a hold of people, he lives in Chicago and I also live in Chicago. So he opened doors to get me to, you know, the people who this person knows this person, and then I would finally got to the material. When I first in my total ignorance started just plunging into this and transcribing it note by note, I had a lot of questions because I had never done work of this sort, and he has spent his life doing it. So I would say, "What does this word mean?" And he'd say, "Oh, well, that word means this," or that, or he would actually say, "Actually, I don't know what that word means." You know, and so it was very interesting. So he was very supportive on that end. And on this end of where we are now, he actually has written an essay for our program that'll be in the program booklet for this production about Faccio, Verdi, and Boito and their connections. Yeah.
That's terrific. Yeah. And is, of course, a real feather in your cap to be able to say that Philip Gossett is involved with this production.
Absolutely, yeah. He is the premier Rossini scholar, if not also the premier Verdi scholar in the world.
And that has caused, I'm sure, a lot of people from around the country and around the world to be interested in what you're doing here.
Very much so. We have major critics from, at this point, we have major international critics coming to see this. We have heads of opera companies all over America who are coming to see this. And this is by far our most ambitious project, shall we say.
Congratulations. You have a concept of what you want Opera Southwest,
yes,
to be. And even though this is a very grand version of that, it fits very well into what you want Opera Southwest to present to the public here.
That is true. I firmly believe that opera cannot just produce the same five pieces over, even though they sell out. There really are only about five operas that are reliably sell out every time, and everything else is kind of a shot in the dark. So I'm a big believer, and also as a composer, I'm a believer of trying new things. Not that this is new, it's over 150 years old, but for all intents and purposes, this is a world premiere because nobody alive has ever heard this. So I'm a firm believer of a real balance between repertoire that the public already knows and loves and things that are off the beaten path. And this is about as off the beaten path as we could possibly get. So this does very much fit in line with what I think Opera Southwest does well and what I think Opera Southwest should do and what Opera Southwest is becoming known for. I mentioned we're having all this international press and heads of opera companies coming to this. They would not come if it was just a production of La Boheme. You know, nobody in the opera world cares if we're doing La Boheme because everybody in the opera world does La Boheme every season. But when we do this, we got it. We have a notice in Opera News about this. They're doing a little article for Opera News. So it is getting the kind of attention that we would not normally get.
That being said, it is still a gamble for you, isn't it?
You know, putting on opera is a gamble. Everything is a gamble. But yes, this is the biggest gamble we've ever done. But I think with the amount of buzz that it's generating at this point and the amount of people who go, gosh, I've never heard this. You know, I've always wanted to hear this. What is it like? It's an experiment. You know, I think the most frustrating thing about this has been reading things about it written by other musicologists saying, oh, well, it's not a very good opera. Because my point is, well, you don't even know that. Like, you've never heard it. Like, you can't possibly. And even if you heard a couple musical excerpts, my feeling is you can't judge an opera based on a recording. You have to see it. You have to experience it as a full drama with the orchestra, with the costumes, with the sets, with the lights, with an audience, with a group of singers who have been studying it and working at it. And just putting the entire thing together is really the only way that you can judge an opera. And I think this is, I mean, I have no objectivity about this project anymore after 11 years, but I do believe, and I did believe early on, that there's a lot of music in this that is a lot better than pieces that are done all the time. And it's certainly a story that everybody has at least heard of. And so there's an immediacy to the drama that I think is captured in this that will very much appeal to audiences.
Conductor and composer Anthony Baresi is the artistic director of Albuquerque's Opera Southwest, Tony's reconstructed version of the little-known opera Amleto by 19th-century Italian composer Franco Faccio, opens on October 26th at the National Hispanic Cultural Center. Additional performances are October 31st and November 2nd. For tickets, visit operasouthwest.org. For details on Amleto and musical excerpts, go to Tony's website. That's anthonybarese.com. That's B-A-R-R-E-S-E. Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Tony.
Thank you.
I'm Spencer Beckwith, reporting on the arts for KUNM. And we'll leave you with an excerpt from Franco Faccio's Amleto, Ophelia's Sortita, from Act 1, Scene 1. Soprano Abla Hamsa with Tony Baresi on piano.